Six pack lap it at. The boys are back. Rory, the linchpin, aka Red Light Rory, Eric Helms, and Matt Gary. It's another goat debate, and I got myself my goats. And this time it is the equipped. But before we get into our equipped goats, men's and women's, we're going to take a look back. How do you know where you're going if you don't look back? And we're going to look at some of the history of powerlifting and what got us here. And we got a bit of a history, powerlifting does, because it's a strength sport. And for as long as we've been around, we've been testing our strength. Eric could tell you all about that. Well, we'll focus more on powerlifting for this one. And Matt, you're going to give us a couple bullet points, and we might jump in with some as well.
Yeah, thanks. I think we wrapped up the classic and we talked about kind of the greatest of 11 years, if you will. But equipped lifting, or equipped powerlifting, as a matter of fact, they've been around a lot longer. So there's a deep and rich history there. That's good for about 50 years, and we have 50 years that we kind of need to look at in terms of world champions and so forth, and legends in the game and greats. But suffice it to say, if we just go back even before that, I think we can all agree that people have been lifting heavy stuff for a really long time. And back in the late 1800s and actually early 1900s is some of the first accounts of people performing what we know to be like the predecessors to today's squat, bench, and deadlift. And actually, Olympic weightlifting was in the Olympics in 1896, if I'm not mistaken. And then actually in the 1928 Olympics, where they had weightlifting, it was three events. So Olympic weightlifting, the overhead lifts as we know them to be, are the snatch and the clean and jerk. But also in the 1928 Olympics, they had the clean and press. And so it's interesting that we've got barbell lifting dating back so far and into these early, you know, Olympics, and we've got nations and lifters competing from all over the world in what we call the quick lifts. Around the 1940s.
Can I bring something up real quick
yeah,
on that, Matt,
which is
pretty interesting?
Please.
So prior to that first Olympics, where it was in the Olympic Games and they had those barbell three lifts, it was actually one of the events in track and field. So it wasn't
what?
Even its own sport. Yep. And they had rotating variations of the lifts, and they would often be dumbbell variations. So the things like dumbbell snatch or the bent press, one hand anyhows, two hand anyhows, and there would be dumbbell and barbell versions of lifting, and it was part of track and field. And it wasn't until the 20s, like Matt said, that it actually became its a distinct event, or rather a distinct sport rather than an event within track and field in the Olympics, which is
that was in the Olympics.
Yep, in the 1800s, it was a track, like you could do, you know, there'd be athletes in track and field who were sprinting, jumping, pole vaulting, but then you'd also have people lifting weights who were part of track and field.
And for anyone listening, anyhow, I remember looking at this back in the day, is just get it up any, like there isn't specific rules, just get it up overhead. So if you were supporting certain ways or whatever, it's just get it up anyhow, which I kind of like. You know, we have these discussions often with our sport, too many rules, the down up on the deadlift. If it was an anyhow, it just means get it to a lockout anyhow, which way, whether it's ramping down.
It's
up
a little bit reminiscent of things like a CrossFit floor to overhead, right? Like how you get it up is not the important thing. The important thing is it starts on the floor and it ends overhead.
Or the current deadlifts in competitive strongman, or if you look at the
overhead
pressing
untested
events in strongman. Or like if you look at a lot of the overhead events in strongman, you will have some of the lighter weight classes actually doing jerks, and then the pressing power of some of the giants is and the, you know, they don't need to do the dip or even the double dip. You'll see push presses, jerks, and strict presses in strict quote unquote presses in strongman. Anyway, bit of a tangent, but I thought that'd be really, really interesting. So
no, it's interesting that you mentioned that, Eric, because the you said that these lifts were part of the track and field events. I think that's why we saw such a crossover back in the day of these weightlifters who were also good at hammer and shot put and different things like and throwing the discus and, you know, just these high power output movements, you know, being successful at both and there being some crossover. So around the time of the 1940s, Ryan, we had these, what we call these odd lift contests begin to emerge that involved dozens of barbell movements, including, you know, the squat, the predecessor to the bench, not having a rack, was the essentially the floor press, where people were benching off the ground until their arms hit the ground. And then just a variety of different deadlifts, straddling the bar, and essentially making it look like, isn't that called a hack squat technically, Eric, where you straddle the bar? Is that right? Or am I using a different terminology there?
You mean the one where I think the barbell hack squat is where you have the bar just behind your ankles.
Oh, behind you. Gotcha. Yeah. And so these odd lift, kind of emerged, and they were different from Olympic weightlifting. And in the 1950s, some of these odd lift contests, if you will, started to fade away, and they actually evolve into powerlifting. And we had kind of this standardization of lifts come about in the mid 1960s. But also Olympic weightlifting wasn't fading. I mean, as a matter of fact, it was strong. In the late 50s and early 60s, we had the United States dominating in weightlifting with Paul Anderson and Tommy Kono and some names like that back in the 50s and 60s. And then we had kind of the emergence of anabolic steroids, where they became readily available. I think my timeline is right there, Eric, in the 50s to 60s, and they began to infiltrate Olympic weightlifting and powerlifting. In 1965, we had the first official national powerlifting championship, and that took place in York, Pennsylvania. Obviously, a lot of people have heard of York Barbell. That's where the plates come from. And that was sanctioned by the AAU, which is the Amateur Athletic Union, which, you know, is also responsible for administering a lot of other sports, not just powerlifting. In the United States of America. I mean, there's AAU basketball now that's wildly popular and so forth. And in the late 60s is right around the time that we had the first accounts of supportive apparel and techniques coming about. And you had people actually wrapping themselves in bed sheets. I've heard that story before, where they took these bed sheets and kind of wrapped their bodies in them and tied them off almost in like a toga-like fashion, but really, really tight to give themselves support. And I don't know if this is a rumor or just hearsay, but I've heard of people taking the old ACE bandages, obviously, and wrapping those around their knees, but placing tennis balls behind their knees to give them actual spring out of the bottom of the squat. And so I don't know if that's kind of this old wives' tale or that actually happened, but you see the supportive equipment begin to emerge around the late 1960s. And in 1972, this was one of our trivia questions in the previous podcast, that's when the International Powerlifting Federation was founded. So it was founded in 1972, and we had the first IPF World Championship take place in 1973. And interestingly, this is the same year that weightlifting abolished the clean and press. And I think, as Eric might note, they did that because I think the judging was becoming too difficult, if I'm not mistaken, Eric, because of the excessive back bends that people were using.
And actually, this the pressing in general has a really controversial history. So one interesting thing is that when you look at the development in the big three of when were people moving numbers that we would consider still respectable today, despite there being a fraction of the population, the squat and the bench press were lagging behind for a long time, largely just because of equipment restrictions. You know, like, if you wanted to figure out what was the biggest squat someone had done prior to the 50s, you'd probably just think about, oh, I'm going to add 10% to whatever someone's clean is, you know? And it's because there just weren't squat racks. And there weren't the initial bench press racks until that we would might actually consider bench press racks until maybe the late 40s or 50s. Prior to that, people were pressing off of boxes. And the floor press often began with a pullover. The pullover and press was actually a competition lift in some of these original kind of odd lift competitions, where you'd start with the bar, you have to roll it up and get it onto your chest or your belly and then press it. Mm-hmm. And some of the first controversies were around using a belly press. So you'd pull it over and you'd bring your hips to meet the bar, and then you'd kind of thrust it off your hips. And there were some records close to 500 pounds that were essentially like a hip thrust assisted bench press. And that eventually became a controversial point. And Bob Hoffman pushed to try to outlaw that. Bob Hoffman, who was that? That's the guy, head of York Barbell, mm-hmm. who essentially is the organizational reason why the U.S. was so dominant in weightlifting. Because unlike some of the other countries which had a socialist sporting engine behind them, like, you know, Russia and some of the, or the, I should say the USSR. It was essentially capitalism driving weightlifting. Bob Hoffman was just an avid weightlifter himself, and he used his York Barbell weightlifting company, and he had magazines and he sold weights to basically fund and give jobs to all of the weightlifters who had come to York Barbell train, and he created this organizational system. And he is basically the, on the organizational side, not the talent side, why there was competition in weightlifting. So yeah, moving on from there was early, you know, and there's still controversy around the bench press, right? With, you know, the recent rule change, which is wild to me. But same thing happened with the overhead press, or I should say the clean and press, is you were getting people who are leaning back more and more because the only rule was that it had to be in one swift, even press, but the position of your upper body, you just basically had to keep your knees locked. So there's a question of how far can I lean back and press without unbending my knees? And then when do I scoop my body underneath to get a mechanical advantage? And basically just kind of the same way it did on Instagram, like, okay, you're not breaking the rule, but the general public really doesn't like what they're seeing, and it doesn't look like the mainstream perception of what strength is. So, okay, now we have a depth rule in the IPF, and back then they just decided, you know what? We're just going to get rid of it. And I think part of it was because of the distinction between your slow strength and your speed strength, you know? So the odd lifts and powerlifting became your slow strength sport, and then Olympic weightlifting, especially once the clean and press came out in 72, it became kind of the fast, or the quick lifts, if you will.
Around that time in the 50s is when Doug Hepburn from Canada, actually, the first man to bench press 500 pounds, first man to bench press 550, and he's pushing towards 600 anyways. But if you look at pictures, and Doug Hepburn was a world champion in Olympic weightlifting. And so he was at one point the world champion in Olympic weightlifting, held the record for squat, bench, and deadlift. This is before Paul Anderson came in from the US. Ended up wiping out most of his records. But he won and beat longtime champion John Davis of the US. John Davis, seven-time world champion, two-time Olympian, was, and he probably would have won more titles if it wasn't for the World War. John Davis, an American, like an icon in strength sports. And Doug Hepburn came out and defeated him and was the world champion in Olympic weightlifting. Held the like this is when before we had world championships in powerlifting, but they would hold the records. The same authorities that would be governing Olympic weightlifting would actually recognize records in powerlifts, which is, I don't know, kind of cool. At least we had that.
It also was what was governing bodybuilding. The AAU actually has its own really, really interesting history. It had a whole, basically a strength sport body where bodybuilding, what eventually became powerlifting and weightlifting, were all under the same governing body. And eventually they split apart. And eventually the AAU stopped being the governing body, I want to say in the 80s or 90s, I can't remember exactly when, for Olympic sports. It got into an intense battle with the NCAA, but that's a whole other history. But yeah, so for example, the Mr. America competition for its early years, the bodybuilding competition, was held the day after senior weightlifting national championships. And for many years, you had to compete in both. And the emergence of the IFBB, the largest untested, for the most part, bodybuilding organization that we're familiar with today, was a move towards specialization and trying to get away from having to be playing second fiddle to these weightlifting competitions. And that's where the Weeders from Canada snuck in and basically were able to win the eventual multi-decade year long or multi-decade long battle with Hoffman, who is head of the AAU and trying to keep the, as you know, function, or I should say form follows function. You know, through the 70s and 80s, that's when he started to lose that battle. And on many bodybuilders, like, listen, I don't want to have to do a weightlifting competition prior to competing. And anyway, so it was right around the 60s and 70s, really the 60s, where powerlifting, weightlifting, and bodybuilding went from being a unified group of people to these kind of three disparate but related tribes, which I think is just really interesting. And I will now be quiet because this is supposed to be a discussion of equipped powerlifting.
No, we said we do history.
No, that's outstanding context, Eric. I appreciate that. And I knew that you would be able to fill in some of the gaps that clearly I was presenting, at least here in the United States. 1977 was a big year for us in terms of powerlifting because Mike Lambert released and published Powerlifting USA, which back then was the, for lack of a better word, the official, I mean, it was the social media in magazine form, in print form, that came out once per month. And I had a subscription to Powerlifting USA from about 1993 until it ended, which I think was right around, oh gosh, the early 2000s or mid 2000s. And I had every single issue, and it's just amazing the rich history. But Powerlifting USA was like a really big deal because this is all pre-internet and so forth. And that's how you found out, matter-of-factly, about what was going on and keeping your finger on the pulse of our sport. You get a workout of the month in there, and you get meet results. And it was really cool because you'd be like fiending for a copy of the Powerlifting USA and trying to find out what happened at meets. Because otherwise, if you didn't know somebody that went to a meet, you had no idea, that everything was just hearsay. But to actually have something physical, tangible, that you could look at in your hands was just really remarkable. So 1977 was a big year. And to Eric's point, the AAU's monopoly on American powerlifting was broken up by the US Amateur Sports Act, and that happened in 1978. So also in 1978, the United States Powerlifting Federation, or the USPF, was founded. And it was the affiliate that was the gateway into the IPF, at least for Americans, for US lifters, all the way up until 1997. In 1981, the IPF began its first drug testing. The IOC had done it, I believe, since 1976, but 1981 was when the IPF introduced drug tests. And the US affiliate, I can only speak for the US affiliate back then, there was no out-of-meet testing. So drug testing took place at your national championships and your world championships. So you can kind of sit there and do the math. I mean, this was in an era when, you know, anabolic steroid use and enhancement and so forth was prominent. And so, you know, you can assume that a significant amount of the competitors were on it, but a group of people wanted to formulate an avenue. Oh, go ahead, Eric.
There's a real, I can't remember the
Yeah.
exact date, and
Yep.
I might need to be fact checked, but this is correct enough to be interesting to people. There was a survey of Olympic throwers that was done in the 80s, an anonymous one of a relatively small sample size, and 100% of them said they were using anabolic
Oh my
steroids.
God.
And there are
Yeah.
still some throwing records that have not been broken to this day, likely influenced by that. People
Yeah.
talk a lot about like, oh, you know, like they're still beating the test, but there's a big difference to a proportion of athletes in a sport working around more comprehensive testing and also knowing that they're probably going to get caught retrospectively these days. And carte blanche, everybody do your thing and just make sure on the day you can piss clean if you happen to be one of the people tested, and not everyone does. And let's just all take a boatload of anabolic steroids, which, by the way, the availability of at least that specific class, anabolic androgenic steroids, has not changed much since the 80s because of the legal status change. So sometimes we kind of have this recency bias. We think the drugs are far better today. Not necessarily. And that's why some of the use cases back then were pretty wild. So anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so around that time when the IPF started doing its first drug testing in 1981, there was a group in America that wanted to present an avenue for clean sport, if you will, or an alternative to, you know, the USPF. And that's when the ADFPA was born in 1981, the American Drug-Free Powerlifting Association. And that was founded in 1981. And another federation was born in 83 that was called the APF, the American Powerlifting Federation. And the only reason that I mention that is because throughout the mid-1980s and beyond, at least in the United States, there were federations that started just popping up all over the place. And that's the real problem, if you will, that powerlifting, you know, that was just a I think a net negative for us, is that there, you know, they were popping up all over the place with varying degrees of legitimacy and geographical coverage. And then everybody said, well, we use the same rule book, but then the standards were being enforced in different ways. And so it was this kind of tumultuous time. Fast forward to 1997, and that's when the USPF was dropped. as the IPF affiliate. And I believe the reasons behind that were primarily because of the drug testing. So the ADFPA, which was the drug-free route, morphed and became the USAPL and became the affiliate formally into the IPF. And that was in 1997. And in the 2000s, again, we saw dozens of organizations popping up and even international powerlifting federations, other avenues now beginning to exist. Also around this time, we saw a shift in supportive equipment. So prior to this point, you really only had two companies that were manufacturing supportive apparel, and that was the Marathon Company and INSER. And so I actually owned some of the Marathon knee wraps and Marathon suits back in the day because I started competing in 1995. And make no mistake about it, the materials being used were supportive, and they were an ergogenic aid that added kilos to your total, matter-of-factly. And the knee wraps specifically back then were, you know, stiffer versions of ACE bandages. But in the 2000s, that's when Titan emerged, Titan Support Systems emerged, and they came out with their version of a bench shirt. So now INSER had some competition. So there's INSER and Titan, and you had just this explosion of supportive apparel. And then we got into stiffer, harder, less pliable material, material that didn't, that resisted more so in the 2000s. And then we started seeing the extra layers and then multiply and so on and so forth. In 2007, Ryan, did you have a point you wanted to make?
No, I was grabbing some, but no, when you said, yeah, getting into the multiply, I remember the multiply untested monolift. I mean, things got really wild for a hot minute there.
Yeah, that's when, you know, Westside Barbell was kind of at its peak, was in the early 2000s, you know, the wide stance squatting, the Chuck Taylors, the unlimited gear that they could wear, double and triple layer suits, the extra long knee wraps that stretched from here to the front door, the high squats, the unpaused benches, and this, that, and the other thing. And it just became a mishmash, at least here in the United States of America, where it was really popular for a period of time there, for about a decade, if you will. In 2007, USA Powerlifting officially began to recognize raw lifting, create some standards. And we had our first raw nationals in America in St. Louis, Missouri, in 2008. And I was actually at that. And I remember, I think one of the super heavyweights at that competition, I'd have to look back at some of the totals, squatted like 600 pounds and our minds were blown because, you know, we thought, you know, that's only for equipped lifters. Nobody puts that much weight on their back and not have anything on their knees. And it's just amazing because now, you know, we've got the Taylor Atwoods, you know, squatting 600 pounds at 74 and so forth. And even some of the 66s are getting really close. Around the time of 2010 is when raw lifting and CrossFit and, of course, social media. I mean, those were, I think, the three biggest things that began to create this boom, this explosion, both nationally and internationally, causing just a massive increase in the number of people competing in powerlifting. And then, of course, in 2012, that's when the IPF said, hey, let's give this raw thing a try. And they came out with the Raw World Cup that we had in 2012. And make no mistake about it, that was a Raw World Championships. It just didn't possess the name. They were just essentially test driving it. But I was there. I was an assistant coach on that staff and coached a lot of the lifters. My wife, Susie, competed. Blaine Sumner competed that year and won the super heavies. Mike T lifted. Kimberly Walford, of course, Jennifer Thompson. So some real legends in the game in 2012. And the IPF saw the success and saw the popularity of it and said, hey, let's really officially make it a thing. And so then in 2013 in Sostal, Russia was the first official, if you will, IPF Raw World Championships. And that kind of just, I guess, kind of gives you a bullet point list of how we got up to this point that we are currently. And now, of course, we're in a climate now where, you know, for better or for worse, in some circles, you know, equipped lifting is almost on life support, if you will, sadly. And raw has just taken over. It's just, you know, it's easier to access. You don't need friends. You don't need a team of people to train with. It's just an easier on-ramp, if you will. The onboarding process to become a raw lifter or a classic lifter nowadays is a lot easier than it is to become an equipped lifter. But all that is to say is that equipped lifting preceded classic lifting. Were people lifting classic and lifting raw back then, like you said, the Don Reinouts and so forth? Of course they were. They were. Some people were doing that, and some people were not using supportive aids, or they were using supportive aids in the squat, you know, a la the ACE bandages and the loose polyester suits that, you know, were the predecessors to the modern day suits. But, you know, Ed Cohen deadlifted raw for pretty much his entire career. A lot of the benches that he took were raw, or the benches that he used were the bench shirt that he used was like an Enzer blast shirt, which matter of factly probably gave you about 10% at most. You know what I mean? Probably more like 30 or 40 pounds. It was just like a really, really tight fitting t-shirt. Now we've seen these shirts just, you know, just unbelievable. I mean, we've got people like Blaine Sumner who have benched over 1,000 pounds, you know, 455 kilos, but have only benched 240 raw. So they're getting about a 90% increase, you know, from their shirts. And of course he's an outlier. I'm not saying that everybody gets that, but I'm just saying that, you know, that's what some of the equipment has evolved into. And so, but hopefully that gives us just a brief snapshot, if you will, of kind of where we've come from. And for the, I think the purposes of our discussion, we're kind of looking at, you know, from that first world championship dating back from 1973 up to the most recent, which was 2023. So we actually have, matter of factly, 50 years there of rich history of powerlifting. And to Ryan's point, as he mentioned in our classic episode, some of the people that we get into and we mention are going to be those pioneers that we talked about, right? You know, that paved the way for the future of equipped powerlifting and paved the way for the lifters of today. And while their totals may not necessarily hold up in every single discipline, I think if we dig a little bit deeper, you're going to find some of the stuff that they did early on to be just as impressive.
Having said that, great intro, gentlemen, as usual. Let's move into the GOAT discussion, and we're going to Equipped, which has a big, rich history. The variables are out there. Equipment's changed. Depth of competition's changed. Rules have changed. So this is kind of a contentious. And I'm kind of interested in, I'll be honest, bit of a blind spot for myself. I know some of the big heavy hitters, but this is not my forte, the equipped. Eric, I believe we're starting with you in the women's equipped GOAT. Who do you have, sir?
Yeah, so just a similar statement that I made in the last podcast on this, just kind of what my criteria is based upon. Matt did a great job defining what greatest is. It's the superlative, singular, best performance. It's not based upon a weight class. It's based upon just everyone, the women's and the men's divisions separately each. And then the thing that I'm adding on to that is that, which makes it more challenging with equipment, is that GOAT includes the OATs of all time, which includes now. So for me, this is harder because I'm not as aware of the history. So I'm going to admit that my picks are my best guess, but I'm going to have some blind spots on how equipment has evolved and what that actually means in terms of how much of a quantitative advantage it will give you on your total. With raw, it's pretty easy because the raw equipment has not changed enough. You know, like there's actually a study that suggested knee sleeves add about 2.5 kilos to your total. So, you know, it's a quantitative amount, and maybe the old knee sleeves added 0 and the new ones add 2.5 or they added 1, but it's something that I think we can assume probably isn't going to be the deciding factor. That's not the case with equipment. The single ply of yesteryear is simply not the single ply of now. And that is something I am just not knowledgeable on. So these are caveated. But the requirement that I had was that not only do they have a sustained high-level performance, multiple-time world championship titles behind their name, but also that they are competitive currently, or at least could be argued to be. And that second part is where I struggle. So on the women's side, my pick is Natalia Salnikova. Natalia Salnikova is a 13-time gold medalist. So that includes 10 world equipped championship wins. two world game wins in 2013 and 2017 in the lightweight category. But, you know, when she's not doing the world games, there's more weight classes. She's in the 52s. And a winning streak from 2011 all the way through 2019, with an additional win in the open category in 2009. And then for her 13th, 2007 World Junior Equipped Champion. Now, the thing that's quite interesting about her, because there are a ton of people who've won a ton of titles in the Equipped because of the history, is that she has, along with Weiling Chen, the oldest standing world record in the Equipped, but this is a total. Weiling Chen's is the deadlift. So she holds the current 52 kilo world record at 530 kilos in the 52 kilo division, and still actively competing. She's born in 86, so I want to say she's still in the open for a few more years. And to me, those things combined, I think, gives her a very solid argument for being the greatest of all time, because she's still currently competitive. And again, all the caveats I said before, I don't know how good of a pick that is based upon what equipment was like, say, in the 90s compared to now. So that's my pick.
Matt, what have you? Who is your pick, sir?
That's an excellent pick, Eric. And I had Natalia in my top three. I actually had her as a coin flip between my second and third pick. I want to go ahead and just, I know Ryan likes history, so I just want to mention a couple of other people if I can. Kind of my honorable mentions. I've got Bonica Brown as an honorable mention on this list. She's won five world titles. She won one as a sub junior in 05. I was actually on that. I was an assistant coach on that team in Ulutornio, Finland, up by the Arctic Circle in 2005. That was the first time that I met Bonica. She won a junior world title. And then she rattled off four more from 16 through 2019. And most notably, I thought was amazing. In 2006, she placed second in the Open at the age of 18, which is just incredible to think that an 18-year-old could do battle with these, you know, open level lifters in equipment and come in second place. That's just extraordinary. She won the World Games in 17, and then again in more recently in 2022, had a very controversial decision there where she came in second, but she's podiumed four times at the World Games. So she's an honorable mention. USA is also Priscilla Ribic, who is the executive director for USA Powerlifting for a really long time, the wife of our of the former president, or I'm sorry, the president of USA Powerlifting, Dr. Larry Maley. She won seven open titles, four masters. She's in the IPF Hall of Fame, 12 open nationals. But again, they're kind of in that tier beneath the Natalia Selnikova, which is who Eric picked. And I had Natalia as a coin flip between for second place between Natalia and Weiling Chen, because and I hold Weiling very near and dear to my heart, because I actually know her and got really cozy and friendly with her at some of the earlier world championships, and came to know her and speak to her through translators and so forth. And just want to talk about an extraordinary athlete. She won eight titles, one as a junior in 2001, and then she won in 07, 08 from 11 to 14, and then once again in 16. She took silver four times, bronze once, and get this, she's competed in five world games, okay? 2001, 2005, 9, 13, and 17. She won in 2009 in Taiwan. That was the world games that I went to in Kaohsiung, Taiwan. So that was a home game for her, and she won. And you want to talk about just a roaring crowd and ovation that she received there. It was really cool. That was in a theater that was kind of like a Sheffield Life experience, if you will, where they hosted the powerlifting for the World Games. And it was just magnificent. Oh, by the way, she's also got two Raw World Championships. I know we're talking about Equipped, but she's got the heaviest total of all time in the 47 kilo weight class, which still stands. And by the way, this was her hobby. She's a weightlifter first. Weiling Chen won Olympic gold at 48 kilos in Beijing in 2008. And so having talked to her and some of her friends, obviously always through a translator, I came to find out that Weiling didn't really spend a lot of the time in equipment because she was busy training for weightlifting. And so she would matter-of-factly only get to throw on the gear. And as we know, I know that you guys aren't as experienced with equipment, but equipped lifting is a skill, and the movement qualities associated with an equipped squat and an equipped bench are much, much different than a classic bench press or a classic squat, suffice it to say. And so she never got really the appropriate time. She couldn't put in a 12-week training block or training cycle, as we know it to be, to get ready for these championships. So just it's extraordinary to me to imagine what she might have done had she been able to devote more time to her craft. But anyway, having said all of that, and this is really tight because, like I said, you can make a really strong argument, like Eric made for Natalia. I've got Larissa Solovyova as my goat. She's now 40. She's now 44 years of age. She's Ukrainian. She competed in the 63 kilo weight class. She is still relevant today. She placed second this past year. But let's take a look at her resume. She has 10 open IPF World Championships. She was unbeatable from 11 to 19. So from 2011 to 2019, she rattled off all those wins and then won in 2022. She's taken silver 3 times. Oh, by the way, she's won the World Games 3 times. Okay. 2009, 2013, and 2017. She has an IPF world record that still holds today in the bench press at 184.5 kilos. As well as 245 kilo dead. She has the second heaviest total of all time, which has only been now passed by Carola Garra, who is 27, but Larissa is 44. And I think that speaks volumes. I was there, I first saw Larissa in 2010 in South Africa, where unfortunately she bombed. But as I said, that next year she came back with a vengeance and just rattled off this string. So it's kind of like, to Eric's point, it this could be a coin toss between Natalia and Larissa. You know what I mean? Because it's like, what do you like more? Do you like more world titles, which Natalia had, I think, one or two more, or do you like world games? Where Larissa's got one more world games gold than Natalia. So it's really just kind of this coin toss situation where I think, and you can make a strong argument. Like I said, my heart and my emotions and my feelings wanted to pick Wei Ling so badly, but I just had to like kind of look at the data there and say, yeah, I think Larissa's got her because she's got a couple more world titles. And while Wei Ling did go to 5 World Games, Larissa won 3. And so that was kind of the ultimate trump card for me. But she's a phenomenal lifter. She never missed a lot of attempts, and that says a lot in equipment, because it's much, much harder to kind of have that 9 for 9 performance. But she was consistently like an 8 for 9 lifter, and if she missed more than one, it was kind of an anomaly. And I just want to touch on two more people because a lot of people, as we talked about in the previous podcast, suffer from recency bias. Look, women have been doing amazing things for a really long time. I want to mention Bev Francis, which I know, of course, Eric will know, the Australian. She was a world champion from 1980 to 1985. Oh, by the way, she was a bodybuilder who competed in Miss Olympia on numerous occasions. And she also was like world class in the shot put. And we've also got American Carrie Boudreau, who won 5 IPF world titles. She won the World Games in 93 and 97, and then crossed over to weightlifting and became, I'm not sure if she was an Olympian, but she was a very high-ranked American level or a high-level weightlifter in the United States of America. So I just thought I would touch upon those people as well. But yeah, Larissa Solovyova is my equipped female goat.
So Larissa's also my equipped female goat. Started powerlifting at age 16 in 1995. And at 43 in 2022, and you're going to like this, Eric, in terms of staying power, last won the world title and then got silver in 2023, just like a few months ago, at 44. So she, in terms of relevancy to today for goat and putting the oat in goat, because it has to be present, Larissa satisfies that. But in terms of, 10 open world titles, 3 World Games, 1 bronze at World Games. Remember, there's a 4-year spread in between every World Games. 4-year spread, 4-time medalist at the World Games. Incredible staying power. And to still be doing it in her 40s, winning titles or podiuming, incredible staying power and been doing it since 95 when she was 16. Think of how beat up her body would be and everything she's been through, and she's still here, not just showing up to show up, not that legend in the warm-up room. Oh, isn't that nice? She's here. But she'll eat your food. Be careful, you know? So I got Larissa as my goat as well, just kind of snowballing off of what Matt's already said pretty well. And Rory, you're the last one to go. Did you have the same, someone different? What do you got?
I had someone who's already been mentioned but wasn't anyone's pick. So I will say that equipped lifting is a little bit of a blind spot for me. I predominantly compete and coach classic. I started lifting sort of as classic was very much on the rise, sort of like late 2013, early 2014. And so I sort of got caught in that wave. And I've done an equipped meet, but only one. And I probably won't go back to it, but I did have a really great time. So yeah, a little bit of a blind spot for me, but I have Chen Weiling as my pick. And so Matt has said a lot of the stuff that I wanted to say, but I will add a couple of details. So her first World Games in 2001, she was the third youngest athlete there. She was 19. There were two people younger than her, but she was just 19 years old in her first World Games. She then competed in four more World Games where she won, you know, only one World Games, but got three other podium finishes, one second and two third place finishes. She won in, you know, 2001, she won the junior 44 kilo class. She won the 48 kilo class. She won the 52 kilo class. She won the 47 kilo class a bunch of times. In 2008, where she won the open 52 kilo class, that was only about 2 months after she won the Olympics and upper weight class. It was literally about 8 weeks later. And so to Matt's earlier point about like not really getting time and equipment, I assume she wasn't training for equipped powerlifting in the weeks coming into the Olympics, right? Like she was training for weightlifting and then just like went off and won a world championships along the way. Then she took a few years off and then won 2011, 2012. In 2012, she won both the classic and the equipped, won 2013, won 2014, took a year off in 2015 to go and break the classic total world record, which I believe ended up being the longest standing total world record in the women's, though it has that. It may have now been broken, but I believe that for a while was the longest standing world record. Came back, won in 2016 again. And yeah, so she's broken 19 equipped world records, still holds three of them, broke 14 classic world records. I don't believe she still holds any of those, but just phenomenal career, probably one of the strongest women to have ever lived, right? Like how many people have won the Olympics and won a World Games and won an open powerlifting world championship? Like that has to be a very small number of people.
Can I add a couple anecdotes that I think are just going to add some extra spice and flavor to this conversation?
Yeah, do it.
Yeah, cool, man. First of all, thank you for picking her. I'm glad that, yeah, that's freaking awesome. I love Weiling Chen. She's a phenomenal human being. I really miss seeing her around. I haven't seen her in a really long time. I just want to add something. So a couple of things. In 2008, Rory talked about her winning the world championships. That was in St. John's, Newfoundland, up in Canada. And she lifted against my wife, Susie. And I don't know the exact date that the IPF changed the rule, but here's the deal. At IPF World Championships, regardless of what it is, whether it's raw, classic, or equipped, it doesn't matter the age group. The night before the championships begins, we have what we call a technical meeting. And all of the head coaches or coaching staffs will attend this meeting. And what they announce is you formally announce your roster at the meeting. And they basically just do a roll call to make sure that everybody that's on your nominations or is on your team is there. And so they call out the names and you say, yes, they're here. And they basically put a check next to your name and they're slated to go. They also give updates to the timetable, any changes that might happen. But the main thing is confirming the lifters. Well, it used to be, it's not anymore, and I don't know the year that they changed it, that you used to be able to come to the technical meeting and change weight classes. And Taipei was famous for doing this. And this was a World Games year, okay? And they realized, so if you go ahead and you pull up the results for the 2008 IPF Equip World Championships, you will notice that Weiling Chen competed in the 52s weighing 48.6. So here's the deal. She intentionally weighed in a little bit heavy over the 47 limit because there was another Taipei lifter that was not as strong, but they knew that she could podium in the 48s at the time and make it to the World Games in Taiwan. So it was a really big deal and score additional team points. So they didn't want to double up in a weight class. So they had Wei Ling intentionally drink a little extra, eat a little extra, whatever it was, so that she came in. And at 48.6, she mopped the floor with everybody. Now she won on body weight, beating Sri Hartani from Indonesia. But suffice it to say, I mean, she just, that was not her natural weight class, 52. She just weighed in over the limit. And they would do this routinely, some of these other countries. And that used to be a tactic. It was a strategy up until the IPF changed the rule and said, no. If you're nominated for this weight class, that's the weight class you have to compete in. And if you don't make weight, you don't get to lift. So it used to be that you could change weight classes. And that was really a strategic play for some of these countries trying to score additional points for their team. The other thing I will mention is the video that I sent you guys in the group chat, which hopefully just gave you chills. I mean, you want to talk about a dog. She is an absolute pit bull, a ferocious competitor. She has an indomitable will. That to me is the single probably most impressive equipped squat by a female that I have ever seen. So she squatted 200, for those of you who are listening, 210 kilos at a body weight of 47 kilos, and she had to replace the bar twice and was running out of time. And I put that in our group chat. You can Google it. You can find it on YouTube. I believe it's Wei Ling Chen, 210 kilos in Orlando, 2016. You want to talk about the guts to be able to put the bar back twice. And she was shaking. I mean, her hips and knees, I think, clearly were not locked and didn't meet the standard to get that start command. And she had to replace the bar. And to finally steady herself and then hit that lift actually on the third time is just extraordinary. I mean, you want to talk, I mean, just got the heart of a lion. So there are not enough superlatives that we can hurl at Wei Ling Chen. And I'm glad that you picked her, Rory, so that she gets her due. And I really do need to dig into some footage because, like I said, I've got some training hall footage of her from Sweden in 2012 at the Classic World Cup that I need to put out on Instagram because I think it would really turn some heads of her just doing some overhead presses and just really cool stuff. So anyway, really happy that you picked Wei Ling Chen, man. She's worthy of that title.
Okay, Matt, would you like to carry us into the equipped men's goat?
I would be happy to. All right. I've got a lot to say, but so I guess it's good that we'll get myself out of the way here. Again, the recency bias thing, man, I just want to give some shout outs to some honorable mentions and just kind of dive into our history a little bit because people think that some of these ponderous poundages haven't been lifted up until now. I just want to rattle off some things that have been done. We had Joe Bradley squat 650 pounds at a body weight of 148. That was at 1982. So again, kind of the old equipment. Dave Waddington was the first man who was credited with squatting over 1,000 pounds. And the unfortunate thing for Dave is that it was done at kind of one of these local meets where we're not sure if everything was to standard. But that was in 1981 at the USPF Appalachian Open. But more officially was Lee Moran. And I'm going to send you guys a link to this in the group chat because we've got another phenomenal video, the story of Lee Moran. So he squatted 1,003 in 1984 at the USPF Seniors in Ohio. So the national championships back then used to be called the Senior Nationals, or the Seniors is what they used to call them. Here's what happened. He walks out on his opener with 432 and a half kilos. That's 953. And the bar came over the top of his head when he hit the hole, and it actually knocked him out unconscious. So he like slingshotted back and fell back into the arms of the spotters. The bar goes down, the rack almost flips over, it knocked him unconscious. He winds up taking that attempt again, crushes it, and then jumps up to 455, which is 1,003. Okay. But the bars back then weren't long enough to hold these 100-pound plates, which is what they used to use. So it used to be four golds is what they called them. They were 100-pound plates. This was before the Alico kilos and so forth. So he had four 100s on each side. And Joe Ladner is actually talking about this in this video that I'm going to send you guys. They didn't have enough room on the end, so they had to turn the vice collars around to kind of get a bite on the bar. Okay. So he walks out 1003 and the collar pops off on one side. And so he's got this seesaw teeter totter thing. All the weights flip off of one side with 1003. The bar goes flying. They take about a 5 to 10 minute break. And he says, nope, load it up again. I'm going to do it again. So he's already dumped one over his forehead, over his head, which knocked him unconscious. Okay.
He's got a concussion. Like that's a concussion. Yeah,
like legit unreal. Right. And so then the bar teeters over on its side and then he comes back. They reload 455, 1003 and he crushes it. And I'm going to send you guys the video. So Lee Moran did it at, you know, a senior nationals where the judging was strict and it's a nice deep squat. You can tell even from the front angle that he's in and just extraordinary. Back in 1974, we had Mike McDonald bench press 560 pounds, okay, raw. Do the math, that's like 253 and a half kilos, right? Weighing 100, that was in 1974. And then, oh, by the way, he dieted down and got to 90 kilos and benched 500 pounds raw, which is 227 kilos in 1985. That's without the shirts, that's raw. Jim Williams, who I know Eric will know, okay, huge super heavyweight, weighed 155. In 1972, that's the year I was born, at an AAU powerlifting meet, he benched 675 pounds. Okay, 305 kilos essentially, raw in 1972.
You got video of all this? I would love to start posting these.
Let me do some find them. Yeah, let me do some digging. Yeah. And I'll copy and paste some stuff into the group chat for you. Doyle Kennedy, who literally looked like, if you can imagine Grizzly Adams, Doyle Kennedy was Grizzly Adams. Okay, he was from the Pacific Northwest in 1986. He pulled 903 as a super heavy. So people think Jesus is the only one that's been able to pull over 900. No. Doyle Kennedy did it in 1986. Gary Heise did it again in 1992, pulled a 925 deadlift. So I'm just mentioning, I'm kind of popcorning around with some famous squats, benches, deadlifts by some of these equipped predecessors who were either doing it raw, the deadlifts I believe were done raw, and some of these and the benches just
didn't come around for a while. Yeah, they don't even help that much even today.
Yeah, they really don't. It's the one piece of equipment that doesn't help that much. It helps the sumo a little bit more than the conventional, but you've got to be a strong puller. So I just wanted to mention, kind of popcorn around with some of these extraordinary lifts on the men's equip side. So let's delve into my honorable mention for just a moment. I think the lifter that Eric was alluding to, the Japanese lifter of great fame, is Hideki Inaba. And yep. I counted 17, but I may have miscounted. It might be north of 20. I could be wrong. So I'll be the first to say that I could be wrong there. But I know that he's in the upper teens in terms of world titles at 52 kilos. So again, he was doing this back in the 70s and 80s. He also won the World Games in 1981, and then again in 2001, he placed eighth at the World Games. But to think that there was this huge break and he was still good enough to make it back to the World Games, but just an extraordinary lifter at 52. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Lamar Gant on this list, okay, in terms of just extraordinary equipped lifters. So Lamar Gant, for those that don't know, he competed in the 56 kilo weight class and the 60 kilo weight class. He's got 15 IPF world titles and a silver. He did this through the mid 70s and the mid 80s. And he is, matter of factly, the only powerlifter ever, okay, to deadlift 5 times body weight in 2 weight classes. All right, 5 times body weight. He pulled 290 kilos at 639, weighing 56. And then he pulled 310, that's 683, weighing 60. for essentially the same times body weight, about 5.17 times body weight. There was an article on Lamar Gant in Sports Illustrated that came out, and it showed an x-ray of his spine, and he had severe scoliosis. And so when Lamar used to deadlift, his torso would literally just kind of shorten, and he had arms that basically stretched down to his knees and used this frog-style conventional deadlift stance where his heels would touch. So you don't see that at all today in conventional. But you used to see that with Lamar Gant and lifters like Lamar and Vincenello, where their heels would touch, and they called that a frog style conventional. So Lamar Gant, just an extraordinary deadlifter. He's kind of in an honorable mention. We had Alexei Sivakhan, who won 7 world titles. He was a Kazakh lifter, and he won champion of champions. That's what they used to call the best lifter back in the day, was the champion of champions. But now I'm going to get into
my goal. Can I real quick say something about Hideki?
Yeah, please.
So. Yeah, I think he's actually won something like 28 golds. Okay. It's insane. He won every world championship in the Open from 74 until 83.
Okay.
Placed second in 84. And then he won from 85 to 90. By the way, he turned to 41 in 85. And then as an M2, he podiumed from 1994 all the way through to 2000. He did bomb out in 99, but he placed second or third as a, it's just mind-boggling to me, as a 48 48 through 56 year old in the 52 kilo class.
Yeah.
So in 2001 actually was his last competition. He placed eighth. But in 2000, he placed third at 56 in the Open in the 52-kilo class.
Yeah. Just amazing. It's
insane. And if it wasn't his light body weight, he would potentially be my pick, but I'll leave it there.
Yeah, 52 kilos is a...
Yeah, that's one of those outlier weight classes. So I'm going to get to it, Ryan, but I'm just going to mention two people that I think might show up on people's radars here for equipped lifting. We'd be remiss if we didn't mention... Sergei Fedosyenko. So he's I don't want to call him a dual sport athlete, but you know, equipped powerlifting and classic powerlifting are so different that it is almost like a dual sport athlete. But he's won 15 equipped titles. He did have the drug testing failure in 2005. Again, don't know what it was for. He's taken silver 8 times. He won 2 world games in 13 and 17. I was there for his 300 kilo squat, which, you know, if you run the math, that's 5 times body weight squat. That was in Puerto Rico in 2012. And I think that world record still holds to this day. Just extraordinary. I think the next person I'm going to mention is going to come up on a lot of people's lists, but I have him at number 2. And if we're just looking at data, it is really, really hard to argue with Jaroslaw Olek of Poland. He is now 48 years old, but he's going to be competing for a long time. And I counted him up. He's competed in the 67.5 kilo weight class, the 74s, and the 75, which is an old weight class, which used to be, it was the 74 before the 74. It was called 75s. He's won 20 IPF World Championships. In 97, he won as a junior. And then he rattled off a string from 2002 to 2018 until he was finally defeated by the goat killer, Chell Backlund, you know, one of the goat killers, if you will.
Right.
Chell Backlund beat him and ended his streak. And then, oh, by the way, Olek came back and won again this past year. He's got 6 silvers, 2 bronze. He's won 3 world games in 2009, 2013, 2017. His lifts at 74 are extraordinary. 370 kilo squat, 220 kilo bench, 328 deadlift for a 908 kilo total. However, I am going to get to my goat. And in a lot of ways, this guy, if I could sum it up in one sentence, Ryan, Ed Cohen is the Muhammad Ali of powerlifting. And I'm going to tell you why. I'm going to tell you why I picked him. Ed Cohen is now, he's going to turn 60 this year. You want to talk about competing in multiple weight classes? He competed in 5 weight classes. He competed in every weight class from 75 all the way up to 110. He competed from 1982 until 2007 and never lost a single competition after 1983 except when he was in a competition based on formula or points. He has 22 IPF world records to his credit, and his heaviest deadlift at 90 and 110 would still be IPF world records today. And these were done in inferior equipment. His deadlifts were done raw. 900 plus squats, that's 408 kilos. He has 37 900 plus squats. 22 were done at 100 kilos, 15 were done at 110. He squatted over 1,000 pounds three times. That's 453 and a half kilos. All of those were done at 100 kilos body weight. He has bench pressed over 500, that's 227 kilos, 48 times. He did it at 90 once. He did 31 times at 100 and 16 at 110. He has pulled over 800 pounds, that's 363 kilos, on 40 occasions. And in all these different weight classes, I sound like a broken record. He did it four times at 90, 23 times at 100, and 13 times at 110. He's totaled 1,000 kilos or more 27 times, twice weighing only 90 kilos, 15 times at 100 and 10 at 110. When you go onto open powerlifting, he is the 32nd heaviest single ply total of all time, regardless of federation. And oh, by the way, not only is he the lightest, but the totals above him, only eight of those totals were from the IPF, which means the strict standards. So you can take a lot of those totals with all due respect and probably toss them aside because they were either multiply or otherwise. Okay. In 1985, he won the USPF seniors at the age of 21. And he totaled 1,000 kilos, weighing 89.7. And get this, okay? Ryan, you like it when lifters out-total the weight classes above them.
Yes, I do.
Let me make this perfectly clear, and this is the truth. When people competed at the same competition as Eddie, not only was it who was coming in second in his weight class, I mean, you weren't going to beat him. It was who is going to out-total him at the meet. And most of the time, Ed had the highest total. And the only two people at the 1985 seniors to out-total him, outweighed him, okay, by 45 kilos. That's 100 pounds. And then 141 pounds was the other guy over him, okay? So there were two guys that were super heavyweights who out-totaled him. He out-totaled every other lifter. At the 1988 Worlds, in Perth, Australia, he totaled 972 and a half, weighing 100. And the only man to out-total him was O.D. Wilson, who weighed over 400 pounds. That was also the competition, by the way, where Lamar Gant pulled that historic 310 kilos. In Baton Rouge, Louisiana in 2005, Eddie came into the USPF seniors hurt. And my friend, Kirk Karwoski, that's my wife's ex-boyfriend, and we all used to train together. That was when Kirk squatted 1,000 pounds, 455 kilos, and he won the best lifter award. And there's video footage of Kirk up on the medal stand accepting the best lifter award. And the first thing he says is, I just want to thank Ed Cohen for being hurt. Because if not for, and they were dear friends, but he said, there's no way that I would have beaten him. I actually helped Ed Cohn get his bench shirt off at the 2001 Mountaineer Cup in West Virginia. That was televised, Ryan, on ESPN.
We
formally met in 2003 when my wife Susie won her first IPF World Championships in Chicago. That's when I actually met him because Eddie is from the Chicago area. The equipment that Eddie used pales in comparison to what they're wearing today. Most of his bench presses, or I should say many of them, were done raw, and I think almost all of his deadlifts were raw. By the way, he was a switch hitter. He could pull sumo and pull conventional. And if you like, in terms of impact on the sport, Ryan, I know you're big on social media impact. He has 255,000 followers on Instagram, okay? His impact on our sport is immeasurable, okay? If you talk to anybody who has been in this sport prior to the last 10 years, unequivocally, probably almost every person will say that he's the GOAT. Okay. He's been in Sports Illustrated. He's been in Muscle and Fitness. You name the magazine. There are sport athletes from other sports who know him, professional football players, strong men know him by name. He's the guy that everybody wants to get a photo with. at the Arnold Championships. He's the guy that you want to rub elbows with. He does seminars. He is genuinely excited. I've seen him at seminars before when lifters are hitting a PB, regardless of weight that's on the bar. He just, like I said, his impact is immeasurable. He is matter-of-factly the Muhammad Ali of powerlifting. And by the way, he won the IPF World Championships 8 times. He won it in 1984, 1985, 88 and 89, 93 and 95, and then once again in 96. Now, that's four different, he also took silver, he did that in four different weight classes. Now, we would be remiss if we didn't mention the fact that he also failed some drug tests. And he talks about that in his book, which I'm holding up right now. Hopefully you guys can see a copy of that, which was published. He talks about that. So his first drug testing failure, I believe, was in 1985, where he admitted he took decadorabilin, which is primarily a bodybuilding steroid. I think, Eric, you can correct me if I'm wrong. That's common among bodybuilders, to repair a pec injury that he had. He admitted to that. He did not know that the metabolites stayed in the system that long. And so he put up no fuss, no fight, and he failed that drug test. The other two times that he failed in 89 and then in 96 were because his TE ratio was high. Now, that typically, again, that represents, and Eric can comment to this to a much greater extent than I can, presumably the appearance of exogenous testosterone use, though no steroids were found in his system. But we'd be remiss if we didn't mention that. And I know that some people are not going to be able to kind of look past that. But I am able to look past that because of the impact that he's had on the sport. And like I said, matter of factly, he is the strongest SOB to basically ever do it. With kilos being the ultimate, you know, formula or the ultimate metric that we decide, his 1117.5 kilo total that he did as a light 110 still holds up today, man. This guy pulled 900 pounds at 100 kilos body weight, and he did it in a singlet. And that was after squatting like 859, 390 kilos. So he routinely was out totaling everybody at the meet, except maybe one or two other people who, oh, by the way, usually outweighed him by 100 pounds. So Ed Cohn is without question my all-time GOAT in equiplifting. And as I said, Ryan, I think there's no better way to describe him than the Muhammad Ali of our sport.
Very, very close. The only thing is the popping for PEDs, and Ali doesn't have that on his name.
Yes.
So it's tough. That's why it's so tough. That's why the big thing with Ed is how people can balance that. And different people have different ways. And I've gone back and forth with it in my head because the era was different. Look, like you look at guys like Captain Kirk. And I mean, that young man was not natty himself, but he didn't pop. I don't believe he popped, but no, like these are competitors.
Yeah.
Right. These are competitors that Ed would be going. It was a different era, et cetera. So it all depends on people kicking around in their head.
And that's why just, I'll cut you off for 1 second. If we're just looking at data and we're just looking at numbers and world titles, it's hard to argue with Yaroslav Oleg, right? I mean, it's just like, you know, that's kind of the one that stands out. Never failed a drug test. I mean, rumor has it he didn't report for a couple and he wasn't found in the OMT, you know, when they called, but whatever. I mean, I don't
know. Those are warnings. Yeah.
Whatever.
For Eric's oats in the goats, or would they be competitive now? Oleg like won the world title, but also Cohen could be competitive. You could also, so they both satisfy that. Eric, what are you thinking? You're next up.
I suspected these were going to be the two potential people that Matt went with, Yaroslav Oleg as well as Ed Cohn. And I was happy with either one of those for all the same reasons as Matt. It's very difficult not to say Ed Cohn, and it really does come down to the drug testing failure. Part of me, the quantitative scientist in me, wants to know what was his TE ratio. The TE ratio requirement has changed over time. That is the testosterone to epitestosterone ratio. The reason why that's relevant is when you're taking exogenous testosterone, not a synthetic form of it. So exogenous just means coming from outside of your body. Endogenous means you made it. Testosterone has been chemically modified in a thousand ways, you know, like decadurobalan, for example, is a synthetic anabolic steroid. I do have a tough time thinking that an athlete is going to take DECA to heal a pec injury and doesn't see an issue with that. Maybe, I mean, again, I was three when this happened. I do not know the culture of what it was like back then, but I know it was different. But I also know that this is a tough thing to compare too. It's like I mentioned in the last episode, you know, the survey done in the 80s of throwers, and 100% of them, these are Olympic throwers, saying I'm taking anabolic steroids. There were differences in this era, and what was considered acceptable, even with the culture of doping just starting to emerge. But it really wasn't until the 90s when this became like thought of generally as cheating, even though there was some testing, at least in the US. So there's it's a tough one. It really is, because I have a tremendous amount of respect for Ed Cohn. And there is a question of, okay, well, if he was transplanted clean into our era and came up at the same time, would he be competitive? And considering the equipment differences, probably, right? I mean, he'd probably be, you know, a world champ, I would think, or at least in contention. It requires more speculation than Yaroslaw, though. So my official pick, because again, I reversed a number of my decisions based upon some of the criteria that I forced myself to be adherent to, is actually Yaroslav Olek. And some of the things that I think are really mind-boggling and that are really, really cool is, if you look at the world records, the Yaroslav has the current 74-kilo world record of 908. If you looked at the column a couple over from that, and you look at the years people were born who set these world records, he was born in 1974, meaning that he set that 908 record in 2017 as a Masters one. And like Matt mentioned, he just won the 2023 World Championship. So if we talk about staying power and being currently relevant, he is the current equipped world champion in the Open as
49.
nearly an M2, which is redonkulous. He holds both the squat and the total current world records in the equipped class, and he is competitive right now. He's won. I mean, I don't want to just rehash everything Matt said, but he's done some winning. He's got three world game wins, one as a M1 2017 at 43, and yeah, he's podiumed or won every single world championships in the equipped since 1997. It is mind-boggling, and it would not surprise me if, as an M2, he won even some open titles in the equipped. So, yeah, I couldn't not go with him based upon that alone. Setting open world records as an M1 is pretty rare, and being the oldest individual to currently hold a world record in the equipped division and being the current world champion makes it difficult for me to choose anybody else besides him. But you take Ed Cohn and you put him in a context where he hadn't failed the drug test, or he was just born a few years later when the culture was different, and I think it would be potentially a different answer from me. And I will remind everyone that when we had the discussion of the best powerlifting performances, I did have Ed Cohn as just an honorable mention of, hey, like, we need to talk about him along with Jan Todd on the women's side. It's just like, hey, let's be mindful of history. So I'm essentially just repeating what Matt said, and I'll leave it there.
I'm also going to side with Yaroslav Olek, because of the three drug failures. And I also am not sure. I wasn't around at the time. Culturally speaking, I have no idea. I used to work at the hospital, and I remember talking to a doctor who was an Olympian in wrestling and represented Canada. And I think this, though, was like the 76 Olympic Games when he was in Montreal. And him telling me, he was on all types of steroids. He was like over 300 pounds. He showed me a picture of him. He was a monster. I don't know how, it would be like wrestling a bear. But anyways, and he looked nothing like that later on in life when I worked with him. And he told me their drug testing was raise your hand and swear you're not taking anything. So the culturally speaking, I don't know what it was like in 84 when Ed first won his first title and what it was like. I don't know what it all was. But looking through 2024 glasses back, I can't give a guy greatest of all time with three failed drug tests. Like, I would feel differently. I mean, this wasn't even around with Muhammad Ali, but if Muhammad for some reason dropped three drug tests, I'd probably look at him differently. But I don't know. So I'm not like going overly hard on the guy. I will take the easier pick for myself with my 2024 glasses and go with Oleg. And the fact that Oleg had a 17 in a row,
yeah,
that kind of consistency is like, I don't care what sport you're in. That's insane. And powerlifting beats you up with gear on, like, you know, beats you right up 17 in a row. And the fact that Buckland came in, stopped them, the Goat Slayer, Buckland, who's got a win over Oleg and a win over Atwood, who also was one of our goats from the last episode. So he's definitely the Goat Slayer. But the fact that Buckland came in, stopped that run, and then at 49 years old, he took it back. That's the stuff you make movies of, you know? And he could be half a century old. We'll see what happens next year, or this year, sorry. And he could be a world champion again. I don't know how long this is going to run. Maybe we have another 17 years. I don't know, gentlemen. So I do agree it's between Ed and him, at least on my mind's eye. We'll see what Rory says. And I do think probably the thing that's going to steer people is the PED discussion, because it's a little bit controversial, but it's interesting. And I'm glad we're having the conversation. Rory, what do you think?
Yeah, so I'll touch on Ed Cohen briefly. Like, it's very hard to look past him. I've got a lot of respect for what he did for the sport and what he achieved. But I excluded Fedosenko for a drug failure. Ana Rosa Castellane, like, wasn't even in the conversation for me, in part because of a drug failure as well. And like, Ed Cohen failed three drug tests. It was a different time. Don't know the details. There's some rumors of some inconsistencies with the way that one of his samples was handled, which mm-hmm. sort of contributes to that a little bit as well. And so I definitely wouldn't say anyone is wrong for picking him, or that he shouldn't be in the conversation because of it, but I can't reconcile that with what being the greatest means to me. So I am picking Yaroslav Oleg for all of the reasons that everybody has already mentioned, but mm-hmm. I will also just add that in the 2025 World Games, I think there's a pretty good chance that he'll be selected for that, and that will make him a Masters 2 lifter at the time. And I think that will be pretty cool. Obviously, that's a little bit speculative. There's a lot of things that have to happen between now and then for that to occur. But if his previous performances are anything to go by, I would say that there's a pretty good chance we're going to see a Masters 2 lifter, like, competitive at the next World Games. And I think that would be very, very cool.
Yeah, dude, this was a good discussion. We had to go places, didn't we? We had to go some places. Look, I'm Canadian. I grew up Ben Johnson.
Yep.
The 100 meters, and he was our boy that freaking popped. And then and to further make it a difficult discussion, all of the people who were finalists in that 100-meter Olympics race ended up popping for something at some point in their career. At the time, Ben Johnson was the only one who popped right afterwards when he won gold. Broke the world record, and it was only till, like, I think it was Usain Bolt who ended up breaking his record. Obviously, his record didn't stand. But then everybody who was a finalist ended up popping, including Carl Lewis, who threw him under the bus. And it turns mm-hmm. out Lewis also had failed some tests, but the Americans didn't put it forward. But so very controversial. So then that makes that discussion. Well, what if everyone was dirty? What era was it? And this is where you talk about when you look at Ed Cohen, the guy he was going against. What was it like? I wasn't there, and I can't take a temperature of the room, and it's difficult to do. But that's why we have these sports discussions, fellas. You know, it's never cut and dry and easy. Any other notes, fellas, before we wrap this up? This was a good one.
I just want to say a big thank you to Matt Gary for taking the time to put the effort and the thought into this that he did. And I'm very grateful for the people who have created the foundation of the sport that did come before us and all the lifters we've talked about, because we do truly stand on the shoulders of giants. And I think we do great honor to the sport itself, not just the people we're talking about when we do things like this. And I hope people understand and respect the history of where they're coming from as they move forward, because you're representing just a little more than yourself when you participate in these activities. They have cultural significance, and I think that's important. So I want to just say thank you to Matt Gary for doing that work.
Yeah, man,
my pleasure.
We are all lucky that a guy like Matt Gary's around and still around. And I remember, like, when I first was bringing him on the podcast, and even still now to this day, and it seriously warms my heart when I see, like, 23-year-olds on social media talk about, like, Matt Gary's the GOAT. Everyone knows that. Like, talking about goats in terms of, like, handling or term whatever, powerlifting knowledge, or people are like, when the fantasy leagues come around and you'll have 20 somethings being like, I shit you not, on the fantasy league, somebody's name in the fantasy league was, I once beat Matt Gary in a fantasy league. And that was like his claim to fame, because that's the regard in our powerlifting community. That's the regard we hold Matt Gary. And there are, like, people all over the world from all different ages. When they hear Matt Gary, that's what they think. And if you beat Matt Gary in a fantasy league, or you whatever, it's like, oh my God. Like, I don't give a shit what placing I got in. It's long in my brain. I was higher than Matt Gary. Like, you know what I mean? It's I don't know. I love that Matt's around like he is. And we could bring him on to a podcast like this. And not only Matt, but you gentlemen. I said it last time in the last podcast, but I'll say it again. Like, I am eternally grateful that you guys come on these podcasts. We have these discussions, greatest performances of all time, goats of all time, and my confidence levels. When people hear these podcasts, if they have a difference of opinion, I'm like, my friends, if you guys want to debate this, whatever, go ahead, but be careful. Be careful. These gentlemen have sharp swords, and you probably wouldn't win this. And when we drop these episodes, I know the research, obviously, like, look at Matt spitting all these stats, but all of you guys, even just wisdom you've accumulated over the years, you could just pull it out of your pocket. I don't know. I'm just super duper appreciative of you fellas coming on here and doing these. And you're the A-team when it comes to this kind of thing. So I appreciate it, gentlemen. So there we have it. For everybody listening, please do subscribe. And if you want to debate any of these, by all means, tag us in the stories. We love a good sports debate, don't we? And until next time, six pack lap of that. Six up. And we are out.